Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
All right, Paul. Excited to do this.
Welcome to New York.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
You know?
New space. We're here in Midtown, Chelsea. I don't even know where we are.
Yeah, I think a little bit of Chelsea.
There you go.
Yeah, West Side, 25th.
How, you guys recently moved. How are you settling in?
You know, like a startup. And I have a feeling I'll use that language quite a bit in this conversation, where like you take this amazing space, you know, I think it's got a lot of, you know, it got architectural New York City vibe to it. But we have a tendency of taking space and then just dropping our computers and then not doing anything with the space. So at some point, we've got to bring in some interior designers or spend some time on outfitting it to make it feel like the NBA's headquarters feel when you walk in. But, you know, one thing at a time, we're trying to build a league or leagues.
And you're trying to start a season. And I think that's kind of where this conversation starts for me. So, you know, every year has brought with it something new. I don't know that the PLL has had a year in which there were three high-level items that carried as much weight or as much substance as we have here going into 26. And that's how I want to frame the conversation. So on the PLL side, you have an expanded schedule. I want to talk about that. On the WL side, you have a full summer season expanding from what has been a Champ Series property over the last couple of years. And then off the field oriented, you've got a renewed media rights deal with ESPN, which I have a lot of thoughts and questions about as well. So those are the three main things I want to hit on. And I'm really excited. But, you know, just kind of before we jump in or dive in, how are you thinking about 26?
We're excited. I think, you know, honestly, we talk about what's our thing every year. And coincidentally, we felt like this year we didn't have a thing. But hearing you frame it the way that you did, wow, we're biting off a lot again. And the way that I think about, you know, my relationship with Mike and our relationship with the company is very similar to having, you know, head coaches in the locker room every year and having our goals, and different than the season, which is very clearly the goal. Can we win the championship? Did we win the championship? In business, the long-term goal is, in our case, can we become a top 5 or 6 team sports league in North America? If you start there as the championship, then you back your way into things like sold out stadiums, million plus people watching, sponsorship numbers hitting XYZ, categories being eclipsed. And we're not there. And so if you don't win the championship as a coach, you go back into the offseason and you draw new plans, you bring on new recruits. And I feel like, you know, both humbled to hear like, all right, yeah, we're making waves and we're building this thing, but I also wanted to bring to the table the acknowledgement of we're not where we want to be. And who would we be as entrepreneurs if we weren't at least addressing problems and trying to take swings and cuts at growth? And that's an example of where we're at today. So the WOL, we've seen success over the last 2 years with the Champ Series. I would say that we're ahead of plans on the WOL. I mean, an astute investor would say, make the PLL work first before you launch a whole new league. But Athletes Unlimited turned over unexpectedly to all of us. And we've begun this relationship with the best professional women's lacrosse players in the world that lasts, you know, for 2.5 weeks a year. And if there's one thing I deeply care about in my role as a former player, it's the competitiveness and the ability to be a professional lacrosse player full time and creating experiences for fans that they enjoy. So we'd have lost a lot of women if they have 2.5 weeks to play a year.
Right.
And then they have their national team competition. So we actually pulled forward plans, and they were really like fire escape plans if AU went away. Because when we launched the Champ Series in the WO, it was always in concert with like, okay, we'll build more tonnage because that season was short in the summer. So we've pulled forward the WOL, and it feels like it's approached really fast. That said, because of the success of the Champ Series, because of the product shifts and the rules and things, the game's amazing.
Yeah.
The fans turn out, the fans are distinct from the PLL, which was really fun to see. So we're bringing in different ticket buyers and different viewers online. And then the stars are abundant. You know, Charlotte North is the most followed professional lacrosse player actively.
Yeah.
And then you have someone at the college ranks in Chloe Humphrey that's probably got a larger following if you look cross platform, including TikTok, than most current professional lacrosse players. And those stars hitting the field in the season for the first time is exciting. So we have a lot to see there. And then on the scheduling side.
Well, hold on, before we move off of WLL, because you said a lot. So there are two places my mind goes. The first is that you're taking advantage of a broader sports moment, which is very fixated and focused on the growth of women's sports in general. And you're doing so on the back of, chronologically, that iconic Charlotte North photo of her being mobbed by fans at Champ Series, which for me, you know, and I think it had as much to do with kind of the texture and tone of the photo itself, but just felt like Michael Jordan. And so I guess where I'm coming at the question from is, you mentioned how the fans are diverse in terms of who's buying tickets and who's tuning in. How are you thinking about the WLL fan as being distinct from the PLL fan?
Well, I think in a lot of ways overnight, we've doubled our star potential and sport crossover potential. And, you know, I would contend that the sport, to the degree that Tiger Woods impacted golf, or, you know, Serena Williams impacted tennis, or Tony Hawk to skate, or Lewis Hamilton to F1, or Caitlin Clark to the WNBA, our sport's never had that. And some people have said it was potentially me, but
right.
If it was me, I think the MLL would have worked. That's how I think about major sport crossover potential, is like you create this groundswell where the professional leagues benefit. You know, you're featured in Tony Hawk's case, who sort of like co-built X Games, but you're featured in an episode of The Simpsons, yeah. And you have your own video game, like hanging out with Tupac Shakur. Like this type of stuff is like very rare and very special. And, you know, to your question, you know, I think women's sports happily is working, and it's taken a long time to get here. And I think the linchpins have been the WNBA over the last three decades, and women's soccer that's gone through three variations of leagues, and now the NWSL is really taken out. But before the NWSL, you had the 99 women's national team. And so we, I think, as a league, have certainly benefited from the rise of women's professional sports. And then you also take a look at women's lacrosse and its history. You know, it's been around for 100 years. It is played at the international level. It's in the Olympics for the first time. It's got about twice as many Division I programs as the men's do. And so we have to now, as the operators of the business, capitalize on that, which means rolling out a red carpet for the WLL players and the teams, creating very real and obvious competitive stakes for fans, so that they tune in and are more likely to attend. And then I think the commercial side comes if you're able to accomplish that.
And the part that you hit on there, I think, is, you know, what I understand is being most appealing for the players themselves relative to the prior incarnation, which is the opportunity to be a part of a team, right? That was, you know, one of the most novel concepts about Athletes Unlimited, but at the same time, one of the aspects that took away so much of why so many of us love playing team sports is because you're in a locker room and you're building, to your point, the way that a coach approaches a season-long goal, you're building toward that goal. Whereas if you're reshuffling rosters every 3 days over the course of a month, and trying to make it very individualized, there are just a lot of women who wanted to be a part of a locker room experience, and now you're offering that to them in conjunction with all the other benefits. But to the last point, you're doing so in service of the fans as well, right? And so now you're giving young girls and their families an opportunity to choose You know, am I a charging fan? Am I a Palms fan? Yeah. And so as a result, like, you're giving yourself the opportunity, as you said, to tell stories around that, and that goes hand in hand with building stars.
Yeah, and we love to see the audience respond. And ways that happens is you attend games, you watch games, you engage with the players and the teams on social media.
Buy jerseys.
Buy merchandise. Yeah, exactly. And that is, you know, mostly on us to create a compelling enough product and tell really intricate and unique stories on behalf of the players. But then in the end, like, our call to action from inception through getting lacrosse in the Olympics through the next era of professional lacrosse is, if you are a lacrosse fan, I hope you can take pride in being a maven.
And bringing somebody with you.
Yeah, exactly. So not only engaging with the product, but also sharing the product with your friends.
Yeah.
That's what's taken generations towards the NFL and now to the NBA and even the NHL.
And that obviously is, you know, a good pivot to discussing the PLL season, because to your point about if you didn't win the championship, you have to reevaluate. One of the opportunities for reevaluation is to offer more.
Yeah.
Right, and to do it at a time of year when you previously hadn't been doing it. So now the season gets pulled forward with 3 games in May, whereas in prior years, the first weekend was the first weekend in June. I guess I want to ask why. You've spoken about why in other platforms, but for those that aren't familiar, why?
Well, I think understanding the history of why pro lacrosse has been in the summer started with available inventory.
Mm-hmm. Broadcast inventory primarily.
Totally.
More so than stadiums.
A little bit of both, because a lot of the MLL teams were playing at college stadiums and they couldn't book them in the spring when college teams were, spring sports were playing. So inventory, not only from a broadcast standpoint, because when the MLL started 25 years ago, you didn't have the WNBA rocking in summer months on broadcast. You didn't have the NWSL. You didn't have MLS rocking the way that they are. You didn't have the emerging like TGL platforms and other things of that nature. So it was actually pretty wide open. So you go, all right, if we're a lesser known sport that can't guarantee viewership, where's the open inventory? So that was part one. And then part two is you don't own venues. So you got to find venues that fit your type. 25 years ago, pre the emergence of a lot of the modern venues that we've seen take development, that was college stadiums. So that's why we were there. And in a lot of ways, we think about our young history at the PLL and remind ourselves that we had to compete with the MLL when we launched. I would have liked to have raised enough capital to launch with teams in markets and pay guys wages that required them to live there and practice during the week. That would have been so disruptive. We would have lost half, probably more, of the talent pool altogether, because MLL created a system. And this is a system in NLL too. And it's a system that we have now, where you can have your cake and eat it too. You can work during the week and then show up and practice on Friday, walk through Saturday, play on Saturday night, and go home. And that differs dramatically from what the WNBA and the NWSL always offered. Prior to the 2024 NWSL CBA, their wage scale was $35,000 to $80,000, with, in most teams, a $1,500 a month stipend to live there.
Yep. It's not that different from what you guys are offering.
At all. Yeah. In the MLL launch, they were paying guys $25,000 to $35,000. And so we went the route, and honestly, respect to the owners who launched the MLL and the NLL, that said, a lot of these guys are getting big time offers.
Yeah.
We're not at a place yet where we think we can compete with those offers. So let's find a middle ground where we can pay them less, still get them to play on weekends. And then if this thing blows up, we'll compete with those offers. So that was the system.
Yeah. With the notion being that, like, we wanted to build
why we're in the summer.
Well, specifically why we want to build off of college stardom. Because theoretically, you could have said, we're going to create pro lacrosse stars, and the guys who are going to come be a part of our league are the ones for whom this is their best opportunity. There are going to be some guys who are college stars that this is their best opportunity. There are going to be other guys who get really competitive financial offers with whatever sector they go into, and they're going to choose not to do it. And that's fine.
There were first team All-American women's soccer players at Duke that took jobs on Wall Street versus
playing in NWSL,
a lottery pick where they were chosen to play in NWSL.
Yeah.
So that's part one. So then the other thing I'll say is like it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at data and say, when is lacrosse being played and when is lacrosse being searched,
right,
and when is lacrosse being engaged with? So we know the play piece. It's a spring sport.
Yep.
Search, you just pull on Google and Meta. I mean, the spikes over the last 10 years, and you don't have to go back further than 2 years, spring and then begins to drift. It looks like this in July, mm-hmm, August, September, October, November, January, February, March, April, May, June, July. You know, and that's what it does. So, and then on the engagement side, if you run a social media account, if you're an influencer, or if you're a university account, like you'll see your engagement pop in the spring. And we see that too, even when we're not playing. Our highest engagement rates are in the spring. So you take that, and then you look at the NBA versus college basketball, the NFL versus college football, even schedule alignment now in global football or soccer. Like the idea that, oh, you know, we're going to play during the college season, you're going to miss out on those recruits. No, you're not. If you build a system where pro lacrosse is in the spring when lacrosse is being played, and college lacrosse is also in the spring, well, if the tonnage is wide enough, when the college season is done, you have your draft in, yep, the off season, and then those guys pick up.
Yep.
So our system is was set up that in a way that predated us. And that said, going back to that locker room scene of how do we become a top five team sports, well, we gotta try, we gotta start punching. You know, and if the data is indicating that success is in the spring, instead of us tearing the Band-Aid off, you know, and losing guys, again, who might have jobs elsewhere, let's test. Let's crawl, walk, run. And there's only one way to do that. It's thoughtfully and with a little bit of gritting of your teeth.
Yeah.
So the way that we've thoughtfully gone about it is, okay, this college lacrosse overlap isn't new. It happens in the NLL.
Right.
And it also happens, it happened in MLL.
Yeah.
But let's try to marry with the tournament. So like after the conference tournaments are over and the NCAA begins, you know, you have 16 teams,
right,
embarking on that. So you're gonna be out those guys, but at least for guys who didn't make the NCAA tournament, they can start on time. Test that. The other thoughtful path is let's talk to NLL, right? And some of you might remember, but when we launched initially on June 1st, it was a clean separation, and the NLL was ending in the beginning of May. And then the NLL didn't play during COVID and had a shortened season in 21 and came back to make up games for owners, and they went all the way into June.
Yeah.
And then they started pairing back. Brett Frood's an amazing commissioner. We talk to him weekly, and we're working thoughtfully to figure out schedule overlap mitigation.
Yeah, and how to be complementary.
Yeah.
So I mentioned at the top, you know, there was kind of a third prong to this, that being ESPN. And the way that I conceive of it is similar to the way that I conceive of, you know, one of the kind of segments of the lacrosse stakeholder influencer group that I spend a lot of time with are college coaches, Division I college coaches specifically. And I've always felt like there's this phenomenon where when a coach gets into year 4, 5, or 6, depending on how long their initial contract is, you can start to see them lose the facade of what they think a coach should be and kind of occupy their own skin for the first time. And I've always attributed it to the fact that when you get hired, you're being primarily, usually, as unless you're being hired internally, getting hired by somebody that doesn't really know you. They're hiring you as a result of an interview process or search. But when you get extended, that means that group that's making the decision, is this what we want to do? They're making the proactive decision, yes. And that is such a source of confidence. And so you come to market in 2019 with NBC, which was both very novel and you know, they very supportive, right? And then after 3 years, make the transition to ESPN. And now you have ESPN saying, yes, we want to be with you. We want to stay with you. We want to be a partner, and not only that, but also, you know, a growing partner, at least as far as the reported equity side goes. How are you thinking about the context of what a renewed ESPN media rights deal means, not just for the league, but also ESPN's commitment to lacrosse?
Well, I mean, you laid it out perfectly. We've had amazing partners going back to John Miller and the NBC team, Pete Bevacqua, who's now the AD of Notre Dame, was on that group, Mark Lazarus, who's now running Versant. They believed in professional lacrosse's chance, and so they gave us a great deal to start. There was luck in timing for us. You know, I'd like to think that we were pretty sharp around predicting where the world would evolve into streaming. But when we got in and we're structuring our deal with NBC, that was 2018, we were raising money in 2018. It was, I mean, it feels like eons ago. It really wasn't, but the media environment was totally different. Box office was different. Live sports were different. There were way fewer emerging sports leagues.
Let me use this as an example, because I'm a big English Premier League fan, and at that point, the Premier League had been on NBC after coming to the U.S. and on ESPN for, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And so I got used to the NBC digital platform.
NBC Gold.
Correct. And NBC Sports. And the last day of the season, you know, having 10 games on linear with like CNBC and MSNBC and Bravo and USA all getting invoked into, you know, complementing the core product. And then Peacock rolls out and I was like, I have to pay more for something that I've been getting for free for a while. And it was just so interesting with respect to, although I don't know that that's actually true, but either way, how I was prepared as a sports consumer to have, you know, part linear, part digital distribution. And so when that was the PLS plan, I'm like, great, I can see every game.
And we're still in it right now. So you're right. We started with NBC Sports Gold, which was a bit fortuitous because ESPN Plus had just launched.
Right.
The reason why that platform was fortuitous is that they would create streaming platforms specific for the sport.
Yeah.
So we would co-op that. And that means we learned about our audience. We got access to more data. It's really hard when you think about HBO Max or ESPN the App Now or Paramount Plus. You have so many reasons why new subscribers come in. It's hard to attribute directly.
Totally.
And then because of the shared properties on the platform, the networks don't share the data. Yeah. So because we were with NBC Sports Gold, we got all the data out of the gates. That helped us build a case down the road for ESPN. Mm. And then that timing piece was our third year with NBC. They launched Peacock, and they were shuttering NBC Gold and shuttering NBC Sports on cable.
Yeah.
And so they actually restructured a one-year deal to pay us to go on Peacock. So that was helpful as we went to the table to negotiate in the marketplace for our next rights deal, as it created some heat.
Yeah.
We would have gotten ESPN, but probably with less of investment if we didn't have the investment coming in, media rights investment for a license with NBC. You know, back to the MLL and NLL days, even a little history of like how the networks used to function prior to streaming is you either did a media rights deal where they paid you for your content, you did a rev share deal where it was split, or you did a time buy.
Yeah.
And a lot of like our forefathers launching a league would do a time buy. Which means I'd go to you at ESPN and say, how much does it cost to buy six windows, three on ESPN, three ESPN, two? You give me a fee. The problem with that is when you're getting paid as the network, you're not going to put any juice into promotion. When you're paying a property, you go, we need to make this work, yeah, and ideally increase our profit margins, so let's promote the shit out of it.
Yep.
And so if you can get to that media rights space, which Doc O'Connor is on our board, the founder of Arctos. He was a partner at CAA. He was the CEO of MSG. He played lacrosse at Dartmouth in the 80s. He says, in his experience of 30 years in sports and entertainment, it's the hardest thing to get is a media rights deal. So your point, you've proven it out. And so we got that on the first turn with ESPN. And then we'd be able to show viewership and streaming growth year over year, such that we get to this renewal where it's another 5 years. It comes with an investment into the business and also a media rights package. They wanted more WLL too. At ESPN, they have a whole division called the W,
yeah,
where they are seeing bigger commercial impact, sponsors coming in. They just announced their women's sports Sundays. And that's driven by evidence. So they're seeing viewership go up and they're seeing sponsorship come in. And so they have, as part of their renewal, they're like, let's invest in the WLL's growth with you guys.
Yeah.
And that's why you've seen, you know, cable inventory, the championship game's gonna be on ESPN. And that's all part of our shared inventory mix.
What was the rationale or motivation behind the ESPN equity opportunity?
Some of it was deal mechanics. So, you know, if you're deep into the media rights space, you know that the elephant in the room, but basically like there's one player and then there's the rest of us. It's the NFL.
Yeah.
And they're so big and they get so much money allocated to them that their shadow hangs over all of us. So the luck, additional luck for us is we've been able to structure our media rights deals on non-NFL timelines. The NFL's latest deal they structured a few years ago was a 10-year deal with a 7-year opt-out. And then the NBA came in and Adam Silver got an amazing deal where he basically 3X'd what they were already getting paid, and the NBA is basically at the level of the NFL.
Yeah.
So now Roger Goodell and Hans Schroeder in the NFL front office is going and restructuring their deals right now with all of their existing partners. And because they're so valuable, I mean, they drive 25 to 30 million people per broadcast. Right. It's amazing the scale they get. It's unreal, right? It's like Olympic scale every Sunday.
Yeah.
And so when they restructure, all of the media companies go on freeze. So we got our deal done, luckily, because if we were restructuring right now, it'd be really hard.
No doubt.
And I share that because the good side of the coin suggests that we're competing with the big four. The other side of the coin is like, you know, we're competing with the big four. And so you have to understand where you are weight class to weight class. And for us, when we went to the negotiating table, we were like, how do we put together a deal where a media company, especially with the threat of big tech, Netflix, Amazon, YouTube, Apple, how do we give them stronger footing or make our property more attractive compared to what other team sports leagues can't do as trade associations? Well, maybe we like offer them a chance to come into our data room and make an investment. So some of that was being provocative, creating a different opportunity that they don't see. And then knowing too, not only are they gonna, or at least more likely to promote us if they pay us a licensing fee, but if they're equity holders, they promote more.
And they get to capture the upside. And I think that's one of the things that is so interesting. You and I have spoken previously about the relationship between Drive to Survive and F1 viewership growth and Netflix's attitude toward the ability to capture the upside for F1 valuation relative to the investment that they had put into and benefit that they had gotten from Drive to Survive. And so I can understand how there's a lot of appeal when it comes to ESPN being able to capture that, knowing what, you know, the bet is on the PLL and on you guys.
Totally. I mean, you know, the entertainment business is about as fickle as the sports fan. And that, like, everyone saw the results of Drive to Survive and wanted to create their version. Now it's super saturated. You can also look at what happened in the scripted realm, most recently with Queen's Gambit and what they did to chess.com and chessboards. And then you can look back at major motion pictures and Walt Disney's Mighty Ducks. Mm-hmm. It literally launched a franchise out of that IP, but participation at the youth level increased by like 50% year over year in the 90s. So you have these cases where you go, damn, this is an area where we should invest. But then you also look at, you know, how you have to land the plane to have one of those yields. And Drive to Survive was really a combination of a great show coming in at the right time on the biggest platform. You know, the right time was COVID.
Yep.
Right? Queen's Gambit, similar, you know, and Mighty Ducks isn't standalone. You have Remember the Titans and others, but a really good story packaged well with the right actors. And then each of those, at least through the context of American fans, were first of. So the NFL, like, we stand a better chance with a new unscripted series or a motion picture to see a big drive in interest and attention than the NFL or the NBA, because everyone already knows the NFL and the NBA. And there's plenty of features and unscripted shows out on them.
Yeah.
So we're in this interesting spot. I call those third doors. The Olympics is another great opportunity for us. And I think at the participatory level, more states that sanction high school boys and girls lacrosse, there's only 27 of them, 26, 27.
So there's opportunity for growth.
Big time, yeah. And those are areas that are indirect to the POL.
Shifting gears a little bit, but you know, not giving short shrift to another large partnership that got recently announced, and we're recording this the day after your new uniforms came out. When you announced Nike as your on-field uniform partner, the term that you used was finally. Why was that so important or such a fixation?
I think about this Martin Scorsese quote a lot now that I'm on the creative side exclusively and not playing anymore, but I found identification the way that I played, and even when I had my YouTube channel pumping content out every Wednesday at 5 o'clock Eastern. It's a simple quote. It's what's most personal is most creative. And when I think about writing finally, it's really personal to me. I grew up and still watch Michael Jordan, you know, and we had our TMM yesterday, and I wanted to back my way into Nike by engaging with the whole company on the GOAT debate of basketball. Who do you like? And obviously, based on generation, people are like, MJ, here's why, please. People are like, oh, LeBron, here's why, please. They're both Nike athletes. Yeah. Like, Nike has swallowed not just the sports manufacturing space for decades, but I think the storytelling.
Yeah, the hero
around
making.
Sports. So much that Steve Jobs used to call Nike marketing, or Nike, his favorite company because of their marketing. And he designed Apple marketing based on what Phil Knight was doing. And if you think about our spot, and you and I talked about this, it's very much in that Nike DNA.
When you say our spot, you're referring to the CJ Kurtz shooting spot.
Yeah, it's very much in the Nike DNA of show me everything but the shoe, you know? And that is like, in essence, a feeling or an experience that you've had. So the finally isn't as much about, oh, you know, it's not shade at Champion or Adidas. It's to me very personal. I grew up as an athlete who was inspired, who wanted to be one of the greats of all time in a sport that was deeply personal to me. And I gathered inspiration before my Jay Dyer workouts, before games in a Hofstra locker room playing for the Lizards, in Netanya, Israel, playing for a gold medal with Team USA. Oftentimes looking at these iconic spots.
We covered a lot of ground, but we have to talk a little bit of lacrosse. I know that nobody knows what this season's gonna hold. If we did, it wouldn't be as interesting. So with that as context, I think it's so useful to get preseason expectations on the record so that you can reflect toward the end of the year and see what's the same and what's deviated from your preseason expectations. So let's start with the WLL, because that's where this conversation kind of started. Obviously, you're not going to be able to have as firm of expectations as you will on the PLL side because you haven't had a summer-long WLL season. But with that being said, how are you thinking about teams and stars and what things are going to look like in August?
Well, we love all of our teams. I think the WLL has an added layer than even the PLL. We made some rule changes in 2019 from what the MLL and the players in the MLL were doing. But the WLL, remember, the champions and the chemistry has been built and established in sixes, and now it's tens. So we trialed tens last year in our All-Star game that we've hosted. But it's wide open, in other words. You have your stars in Charlotte North and Izzy Skane and Ellie Massera and Ali Mastriani and like these, you know, Marie McCool is gonna make her debut, and they will most certainly impact the games. But the 10-on-10 strategy and the way that the coaches and the players are approaching that is new to all of us. So that's really exciting. Look, we pitted the charging versus the guard to kick us off, you know, because that's a rivalry that we've seen for the past two championship series. And then you have Izzy in Charlotte and you have New York and Boston. And that's really cool.
Yeah.
So that'll be exciting to see unfold.
Cool. And then on the PLL side, I guess the way that I'm thinking about like the PLL? Because you made the point, 2018 feels eons ago. It's 8 years ago. It's half a generation ago. And it's weird, but I kind of feel like we've had already two established eras of the PLL, the Whips and Ace era and then the Archers era. And now we're in a little bit of like a, are we in another mini era, or how is this going to develop? And so, you know, with that as basis, how are you thinking about the PLL season?
Well, this is why you're the best at what you do. You should just be calling this, not me. But I think it's framed really well. I'm going to use that. I think Pressler did a kick-ass job last year.
It's indisputable.
And New York was, you know, if not in toe-to-toe with the Denver Outlaws, the best team start to finish. And it was really amazing to see those two teams meet, you know, in northern New Jersey at SI Stadium for the championship. You don't often get the two best teams playing for a championship in pro sports. And that's what makes playoffs great. There's usually an upset.
Yeah.
So seeing that come to fruition, this Denver Outlaws team is really well positioned, and they're going to have...
They're so young, but they're so... Well, like just the talent is so complementary to each other internally that you.
Yeah, you have Brendan O'Neill and Pat Cavanaugh and Jared Bernhardt, who are, I think, three of the most talented players of the modern era that are just getting started in the pro ranks. I'm really excited to see them continue to go. And then you have Venom because they lost and they felt like they should have won. The New York Atlas, you know, you look at the last two MVPs and Jeff Teat and Connor Schellenberger, and you're like, well, this is worth the price of admission. So really fun lacrosse to see. And then lurking over here, you have three teams that have three GMs, Spencer Ford, Joe Spallina, and now most recently Dave Cottle, that have, I think, been leaders in driving new team roster composition. And that look feels a lot like the look that we all grew up with in the MLL. Right out of the gates, they know the nuance of trading. So I see Joe Spallina at the draft, and he's like working the phone, getting in and outside of the room. And that skill has to be taught, learned at some point. And I'll raise my hand as a league is, you know, we, for a lot of reasons, brought in coaches and GMs. And we look at even, you know, Bill Belichick is the greatest placeholder for that in his time in the NFL. But missed the concept of, especially as wages have grown since 2019, missed the concept of like, it's really difficult to negotiate as a coach with your player, with your star player on your team, and also keep space in the back of your head that if this doesn't go well, I can unlock this budget to go get that guy who's going to be a free agent in a week. That's asking a lot out of someone who hasn't existed as a general manager. So that's why I mentioned those three. And what Dave Cottle's assembled sort of overnight with Bill Tierney is pretty exciting. They have so much talent. But I remember the Dogs were early favorites last year. They started out really hot, and then they hit a bit of a cold spell.
It's a really good note and kind of a good place to end too, because, you know, when I think about the Atlas, if they aren't able to create another era for themselves, one of the things that I'll have trouble moving past is their inability to retain Gavin Adler. And for me, it's the best example of PLL free agency that we have so far, insofar as what it actually means, yields, how it operates, and everything that goes along with it. And there's also, you know, the part of the story that maybe not that many people know, but he also works at an agency, right? So it's like, you know, he's going to be more attuned to the notion of what free agency means with respect
and
to
how he's represented by the agency that he works at.
There you go. Yeah. So I also don't want to discredit the point you made about GMs, because obviously they're the ones whose responsibility it is to navigate it, right? And the Atlas have a GM now, but they didn't, during when free agency occurred. And so now you've got these three rosters, and all of this is to say, like, this is the foundation whereby if one of those three teams, I don't even want to say unexpectedly, but relative to fan expectations, unexpectedly emerge, it's going to be hard not to point to it and say, it's because those guys have known pro lacrosse really, really intimately for 25 years.
They know it, and they know how to move through a very real and very new free agency. players getting paid a lot more than what we were getting paid when I was playing.
To the point about it should be the reason, I'm not saying that it should be the reason you make your decision, but it is justifiable if it is the reason that you make a decision for which team you want to be a part of.
Yeah, and I'll give a tip of the cap to the NLL too and the sponsorship environment. There are more than a dozen players just by playing in either the PLL exclusively, we have some guys that can eclipse this number, or they're doing PLL and NLL and they're clearing six figures pretty cleanly. Not running camps and clinics, none of that stuff, just playing. So to give you an idea of where the wages have grown, you know, when I was, you know, getting the max wage in MLO was 16 grand. You know, now guys are making north of or in close to 80K.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing not having to live in a market, not having to practice during the week. Now, I hope that when we choose to sell teams and we bring owners in, that those wages double right out of the gates. And as a result, the value proposition of selling teams is getting those players in market. So they're practicing, they have a venue that they call home, and the touring model switches to home and away, and the business model shifts. But that's what we've been building towards, trying to create as much enterprise value and interest and attention and commercial viability to professional lacrosse, such that when we give it to better hands, it's already in a full stride. One more thing I want to make call out to while we're talking about the game is Brian Holman. Mm. You know, these are two-time Champ Series winners. They've been knocking at the door. They had a rough season last year. But I'm bringing up Brian because he's done a good job of coach GM of intentionally building his team of like PLL only guys. Mm. And that's also why when they were in the Champ Series, they're super bummed because they wanted to go a three-peat.
Yeah.
You know, part of the Champ Series, take the Denver Outlaws, is a lot of those guys play in the NLL, so they weren't there.
Yeah.
And Brian Holman's team was fully stacked when they were there both times. And I like that approach. I like teams to differentiate themselves. And by the way, when I was at training camp, Matt Campbell looked like the best player I've seen in a decade. Like he, maybe it had just been this one practice. No, every time the ball on his stick, he was getting an assist, a second assist, or scoring a goal. Every single time. I was like, wow, this is, I mean, it was like peak Schreiber type of vibe. Like, whoa. So he could be the MVP this year and the Cannons could be playing for a championship.
And if that were to be the case, that would just be so redeeming from the standpoint of what I believe pro lacrosse's primary benefit has been. Not what it will be over the course of the next 26 years, but has been over the last 25 years. And it was an opportunity to see lacrosse players develop into their athletic prime, right? And you were an incredible example of this. But you're not the example that I point to for this particular point, because when you finished up at Hopkins, your profile was already really, really high. Brendan Mundorf is the guy that I always point to where I say when he finished up at UMBC, he was an honorable mention All-American who was playing for the Australian national team in the 2006 World Championship. By 2010 or 11, he was competing with you for the best player in the world.
Yeah.
And nobody wouldn't know about that if it hadn't been for Major League Lacrosse. And if Matt Campbell, who I don't remember where he topped out at accolades-wise at Villanova, but if he is the PLL MVP and then if he makes the U.S. national team and goes to LA 28, like that is such an incredible example of the platform that pro lacrosse has been able to give these athletes, and to the point is going to continue to provide.
So. Yep. Well put.
Paul is great.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate you.
Yeah, for sure.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.